to the First Things podcast. On this episode, I'll talk with Senator Ronan Mullen of the Irish Parliament about the Eighth Amendment to the Irish Constitution. The Eighth Amendment is exceptional in the developed world. It guarantees the legal protection of unborn human life. It was passed in 1983 and is now threatened by a campaign for repeal. Senator Mullen will explain who is pushing this campaign and why, and how pro-lifers in Ireland and America can work to protect this important protection. Then I'll sit down with First Things editor Rusty Reno and get his take on recent developments in church, politics, sports, and fashion. I'm Associate Editor Julia Yost. Thanks for joining us. In 1983, the people of Ireland voted on a referendum for or against a constitutional amendment protecting unborn human life. The amendment passed with 67% of the vote. The result was the Eighth Amendment to the Irish Constitution, which reads as follows. The state acknowledges the right to life of the unborn and, with due regard to the equal right to life of the mother, guarantees in its laws to respect and, as far as practicable, by its laws to defend and vindicate that right. Ireland's Eighth Amendment is to die for if you're a pro-life American in the Roe v. Wade era. Though it's been qualified in certain respects since the famous X case of 1992, the Eighth Amendment has made Ireland a shining example to the developed world. You can outlaw abortion in most cases and have a low maternal mortality rate, and everyone can get along, and it's all quite humane. Now along comes a campaign to repeal the Eighth Amendment and liberalize Ireland's abortion laws so that Ireland comes to resemble, say, Britain, where one in five pregnancies ends in abortion. I'm joined by Senator Ronan Mullen, an independent member of the upper house of the Irish Parliament and a longtime advocate for pro-life causes in Ireland. Ronan, it's good to have you.
It's a pleasure to be here. Thank you.
Ronan, could you give us a brief history of the Eighth Amendment and the ways in which it's been qualified since 1983?
Well, in a funny kind of way, it all starts with America, because with the judicial activism that led to Roe versus Wade, came a tendency to judicial activism in Ireland, where our constitution of 1937 was interpreted to find or to allow a right to privacy. And that led to a decision in the famous McGee case, where a legislative ban on contraception was struck down on the basis that it involved a breach of marital privacy. People on the pro-life side in Ireland, although they weren't organized at that point, were nonetheless conscious that a day could come when Irish judges might find that there was also a right to abortion in the Irish Constitution as a matter of privacy. But then as well came those who wanted to introduce abortion into Ireland in the late 1970s, and the advent of a pro-abortion campaign meant that pro-life people realized they had to get their act together, and they sought and succeeded in getting the political establishment to agree to bring forward an amendment. And the way it works in Ireland is that to change the Irish Constitution, the basic law with which all legislation must agree, the Parliament has to vote to put such an amendment before the people. So there was quite a job to be done to get politicians to agree to hold this constitutional amendment. There were fights about the wording. There were politicians like the former Prime Minister Gareth Fitzgerald, who was in favour of the wording at one point, and then, maybe coming under pressure from media and others, sought to backslide on a commitment that he had given. But it all did lead to a referendum in 1983, and the equal right to life of the unborn was enshrined in the Irish Constitution as part of our basic law, and it was passed by a very substantial majority. So that famous clause which you've read out is something that we've been very proud of in Ireland. Other pro-life people in other countries have been in touch with Irish pro-life activists over the years to, you know, to get advice. We in a sense blazed a trail. There wouldn't be many countries in the world where the right to life of the unborn and the equal right to life of the mother is expressed so clearly and well. There was, of course, plenty of squawking at the time and subsequently by the media that this was a counterproductive development, that it would put women's lives at risk, or alternatively, that it would lead to widespread abortion. It is true that in the famous X case of 1992, the then Supreme Court found that equal right to life clause did allow for a right to abortion where there was a real and substantial risk to the life of the mother, including by way of a threat of suicide, which of course was the really controversial part of that decision in many ways. But it's still fair to say that the enshrining of legal protection for unborn children as a matter of constitutional law did take the decision on this away from judicial and parliamentary elites. What we've seen in other countries is that abortion gets imposed either by judges in cases, in test cases, or sometimes when governments are depending, perhaps coalition governments, depending on a radical minority element, the price of support for being in government is that they would introduce radical legislation even when people aren't up for it. That has happened in other countries. Our constitutional amendment prevented that from happening and was largely successful, which is why today in 2017, we still have substantial protection for unborn children, subject to that exception that was carved out in the X case. And it's why the next move for those who want abortion in Ireland, they have to persuade the Irish people to change the law.
Right. So tell us about the current movement to repeal the Eighth Amendment.
Well, it's been going on for some time, of course. It's a movement that is not, it is not a grassroots movement across Irish society. If you look at marches or occasional demonstrations that take place on this issue, most of the time pro-life demonstrations are far bigger. When politicians tell you that this issue is raised at the doorsteps during election time when they're canvassing, it's most of the time people with pro-life concerns who raise it with them. But of course, as in other countries, there is a substantial liberal bias in the media. And unlike the United States, for example, you don't have a corrective, you don't have a balancing sector of journalism. There's no Fox News in Ireland, to counteract the heavy liberal bias that you find in our state-funded broadcaster, RTE, or in most of our newspaper columns. So you have a media campaign. What I would like, it's more of a media swell than a groundswell. But it's a very powerful element, because in Ireland, as in other places, politicians are very conscious of what the media say about them. And we sometimes find ourselves in that situation described by the poet William Butler Yeats, that the best lack all conviction and the worst are full of passionate intensity. There are many pro-life politicians, but they prefer to keep quiet about it because there's no great reward to be had in the media. In fact, you're going to be targeted for your supposedly conservative views. Whereas if you're on the liberal, so-called liberal side of the argument, you're going to enjoy more plaudits and get more plaudits from the media. So the media is a big player, and they have been pushing this issue for a long time. The other substantial player, apart from the media, is in recent times, American foundations. George Soros, his Open Society Foundation, are putting hundreds of thousands of dollars, at the very least, into various different activist organizations who campaign for abortion. Amnesty International, for example, its big focus in Ireland is abortion. It's a perversion of what it was set up to do, but their big obsession is to get abortion into Ireland. The Planned Parenthood affiliate in Ireland, the Irish Family Planning Association, they get large amounts of money from Planned Parenthood, but also from Soros. So what we're seeing is an attempt to really engage in social engineering in a small country like Ireland, 4.6 million people in the Republic. When this referendum happens, if there is to be a referendum, about 2 million will vote. So the impact of American money coming in on the pro-abortion side of this is very substantial. It is about conditioning public opinion so that when a vote eventually takes place, it might be a vote to remove constitutional protection for the unborn. The positive side for the pro-life movement, for the pro-life campaign, which I work very closely with, is that there are large numbers of people in Ireland who really fear what an abortion culture is and what Ireland could become if once we decide that that some unborn children should not have the protection of the law.
When is the referendum going to take place, or is it going to take place? What are the political mechanics involved with this?
The government established what's called a citizens' assembly, which is composed of 99 ordinary citizens, supposedly representative of the electorate, chosen by a polling company using the electoral register, with a judge in charge. And this citizens' assembly has been tasked with debating and discussing the issue over a period of several weekends over these months, ending with a recommendation from them to the government and parliament. We are not happy with this citizens' assembly. Only in the last few days we found ourselves having to, when I say we, I'm talking about pro-life people and the pro-life campaign, found itself having to criticise the fact that the assembly, when it wanted to give the deliberating members an overview of abortion in different jurisdictions, who did they go to? They went to the Guttmacher Institute, you know. So the idea of going to, you know, such an activist player to give these citizens an overview of, you know, the state of abortion law in different jurisdictions really suggests a very flawed approach by the Assembly. And that point has been made in this very day, as I'm speaking to you, in Irish media by the pro-life campaign. So if we assume for a moment that the Assembly comes back with a recommendation in favour of change, in favour of holding a referendum to remove constitutional protection for the unborn, this, of course, will be taken then through the political process. The government, if it wants to follow through on that, will be able to point to the Assembly as if to say, this isn't coming from us, it's coming from representatives of the people whom we tasked to look at this. There'll be no mention by the government of the tendentious nature of some of the presentations that we're supposed to be giving people an overview, supposed to be neutral and so on. But nonetheless, it will have to go through the political process, be discussed by a committee of the parliament. Eventually, a decision will be made by government to, if they make this decision, to put a referendum. That will have to be mandated or permitted by a vote of the parliament. But it is the people who will have the final say, thanks to the efforts of those who campaigned back in 1983. This cannot be done over the heads of the Irish people. The Irish people must vote to allow this change to the constitution or not. And there can be no further legislation for abortion in Ireland unless the people first change what's in the constitution.
And what is the threshold for amending the Irish constitution? Is it simply 50% plus one of the vote?
Correct. A simple majority of those who vote.
Of those who vote.
Of those who vote.
What do you anticipate as the turnout? How many people are likely to go to vote?
Well, that will depend on a lot of things. That could even depend on the weather, you know, but it will also depend on maybe the state of confusion, the state of passion around the issue. Sometimes referendums, you know, take place in Ireland and people are quite apathetic and a much lower turnout takes place. You could be around, you know, 40%. That would be a lot lower than the numbers who would vote in a general election. On an issue like this, however, I think you'll have a much higher turnout than that, because it is an issue where, you know, people, you know, feelings run high. There's very diverse views in Ireland on that. There will be a huge amount of attention given to it in the media, and I would expect that you would have a turnout of between 60 and 70% on an issue like that.
It's so interesting to think about this from an American perspective, because we're used to thinking of, you know, 60 million people voting in an election. But the numbers you're dealing with in Ireland are, from an American perspective, quite small. And so it's just interesting to think about how manageable a project it can be for one side that is very committed to reach the hearts and minds of people and motivate them and persuade them. you're particularly associated with one anti-abortion organization, the Pro-Life Campaign. Can you tell us a bit about that organization and also about its tactics? What is the Pro-Life Campaign doing to move public opinion on life issues?
Yes, of course. The Pro-Life Campaign is the successor organization of the Pro-Life Amendment Campaign, which was the main lobbying organization which worked with politicians to secure the Eighth Amendment to the Constitution, the Pro-Life Amendment, back in 1983. It's an organization that operates very well at grassroots level. It has members all over the country. It is non-denominational. It's not confessional in any way. And I think this is a point that is very important about pro-life advocacy in Ireland. You know, we have always spoken about this issue as a matter of human rights and human dignity, and even of human decency. You know, that the that letting everybody into the human community is a no-brainer for, and should be a no-brainer for, people of all faiths or none. And we recognise, of course, there are tragic and difficult cases that one really has to think about. But it is possible, when one looks at the situation honestly and with compassion, to say that abortion is never the right answer to any human difficulty. In fact, it creates difficulties. But you know, the Pro-Life Campaign is strong at a grassroots level. It's growing its resources. There's a dynamic, new team in recent years running the Pro-Life Campaign, who are really building it up. Trying to develop its resources for the ongoing work of educating, the public about the importance of protecting the unborn, but also of the various issues that arise. And as you say, you know, we're dealing with small numbers in terms of population. I think the last referendum, about 2 million people voted. And that is why, of course, we face this challenge of money coming in from abroad. You know, $4 or $5 million over a period of few years can really have an impact. And we've seen that on previous occasions. Perhaps the most noticeable occasion was the marriage referendum, because there was a major bankrolling of groups seeking the yes vote on that occasion. And we saw how powerful that could be. And in fact, George Soros has said, you know, in one of the WikiLeaks documents, I think it was, they explained the reason why they're putting all this money into pro-abortion advocacy in Ireland, which is that if a country with a Catholic reputation like Ireland is seen to change its laws and to permit abortion, that this can give great leverage in other countries where they are seeking to bring about abortion in the law in, for example, Central America, or, you know, Eastern Europe, or in Poland, or wherever. So while Ireland may be small, you know, what happens in Ireland, for good or ill, will resonate and impact on this issue in other countries in the world. And all the more so because we had this combination of having a pro-life law, but with, you know, very good, by which I mean low, maternal mortality rates, you know, top-notch care for women in pregnancy. So we were a proof that you don't need abortion to save women's lives. And in that sense, we were an affront to those who seek to use, you know, health grounds as, you know, the wedge issue to get abortion legalized in various jurisdictions.
I wonder, is George Soros an issue that you can sort of take to the people? I mean, I think that in the United States, there's a certain awareness and suspicion of this sinister bazillionaire who's always pouring money into progressive causes. Is there a kind of awareness of him that you can mobilize in Ireland?
Well, we certainly seek to draw attention to it, but this is one of the problems about having a monolithically, you know, biased media, in that this kind of story simply doesn't get traction, because so many journalists are, you know, nodding their heads in agreement at the idea that if George Soros is what it takes, then so be it. If the shoe were on the other foot, and if there was a billionaire, you know, bankrolling the pro-life cause in Ireland, you know, we would never hear the end of it. That's the honest truth. There's nothing wrong, of course, in principle with, you know, people seeking to fund, you know, causes internationally. But it shouldn't be billionaires buying up votes and manipulating public opinion. But there is nothing wrong with people contributing to charitable work, you know, in a way that is transparent and accountable, and that where it reflects, you know, ordinary people's desire to be in solidarity with good people fighting noble causes elsewhere. But that's not what we're dealing with when with Soros. You're dealing with high level, you know, colonialist type intervention with the affairs of a small country, and for an evil purpose, to be frank.
What does the polling on life issues look like in Ireland right now?
We put it as a kind of a 20-60-20. It obviously varies, and events impact on the state of public opinion. But it's probably fair to say that there's probably around a solid 20% of people who get the need to keep Ireland's law fully pro-life, and who get that you don't need abortion. You know, it's not part of good medical treatment, and so on. But there's another 20% or thereabouts who are liberal, who, you know, see it as a matter of choice, who buy into the dominant ideology of Western culture. And what you have then is a very large 60% in the middle or thereabouts, who are, you know, worried about difficult and tragic cases, and who are increasingly the focus of media, you know, in presenting various hard cases, which, you know, in the media's worldview and in the view of pro-abortion campaigners, add up to being a reason to get rid of the protection of the unborn from the Constitution completely. So I'm talking about cases of fetal abnormality. I'm talking about, rape cases. You're talking about, you know, difficult kind of health cases where doctors really have to work hard to protect both mother and baby. These cases, of course, get used as the wedge, not to create a small number of exceptions, but what they will be used is as an argument to get rid of protection for the unborn completely from the Constitution. You know, so it's quite possible, if we do have a referendum, that it would be a referendum just to delete the constitutional protection for the unborn, and to leave the legislators therefore free to make up their minds and to decide the extent to which abortion would be permitted in the state. And it's quite possible that as part of the carrot, you know, we'll be shown some very restrictive piece of legislation. But of course, if once the people take away their own right to decide this issue in final appeal, it won't be long before there's further liberalizing legislation.
So if there's this persuadable 60%, we know what the pro-abortion side is going to say to those people to get their votes. What does the pro-life side say to them?
I think we're living in a time when arguments are very important, but even more important than arguments are stories, you know. And we've got to work really hard to get the positive story about how the Eighth Amendment has saved thousands and thousands of lives, as it has done. The Pro-Life Campaign recently commissioned an actuarial study, which at a conservative estimate says that 100,000 lives have been saved as a result of the passage of the Eighth Amendment in 1983. And that's immediately obvious if you look at, you know, the tragic fact that several thousand Irish women go to Britain for abortions every year. We're told that about 4,000 do so. That would amount to about one in 19 pregnancies. In Britain, four times as many pregnancies end in abortion, about one in five. So there you have it in clear contrast. You know, it is, of course, a tragedy that any Irish woman would go for an abortion, but it's happening far less because our law represents a different set of values, and that has an educative effect, and there is that kind of antipathy to abortion. You see it and reflected as well in the fact that far fewer pregnancies diagnosed, for example, with Down syndrome end in abortion. You know, in Britain it's 90%+ of babies with Down syndrome are aborted. Denmark, the great and the good, they have this plan to be Down syndrome free by 2030. As one poet on Irish radio put it before Christmas, all will be well and all will be Orwellian. But in Ireland, there is that great love for children with Down syndrome still, and we're very proud about our activity in the Special Olympics and so on. And I think that's something we really have to hold on to. And we need to get that story out, how that gentleness, that respect for life in its most fragile moments is really one of the best things about us as a country, as a nation. So we've got to get that story out. I saw recently the Pro-Life Campaign have a very fine leaflet with a young woman and her child, where she says that the time that it took me to arrange an abortion in England was the time that it took me to change my mind. You know, we know quite a few people who dithered, to be blunt, who had the abortion appointment made, in some cases making it, cancelling it, making it a second time. But you know, the Irish law saved those people from making a decision that, looking back on it, they're horrified to contemplate they even came close to making, you know. And all the time we know that in the background there are people who've had abortions, and I think, you know, people in the pro-life movement in Ireland, including the pro-life campaign, you know, we're conscious that what we want to offer is not a message of condemnation, but a message that there is always healing, there is always hope for a better day. But we have to find a way to communicate our message that abortion is always the wrong solution, but always holding out to those who have travelled that road. First of all, allowing those who have a story of pain and hurt to tell as a result of chosen abortion, their voices need to be heard. Again, the media is very uninterested in the cause of those, for example, women in the Women Hurt organisation who speak about how, in some cases, they were pressured into abortion, how they were hustled into it, how they got low-grade, poor-quality pregnancy counselling, and who really regret their abortions. You know, the media are very, very slow to let those stories be told. There was an investigation done, an unofficial investigation done a few years ago in Ireland of pregnancy counselling clinics, including state-funded pregnancy counselling clinics, including the Irish Family Planning Association, and you know, tapes show that, you know, women were given all sorts of dangerous and irresponsible advice. You know, told, for example, if they had an abortion in Britain and they suffered complications, to come back and not to tell their doctor they had an abortion, but to say that they'd had a miscarriage. You know, advice which one of the masters of our maternity hospital said was literally dangerous advice to be given women. So, you know, these people who claim that they're pro-life and that they claim that they're pro-woman and that they care about women's health, you know, seem to have a greater interest in protecting the reputation of abortion than in allowing the story be told that abortion actually could lead to complications. We know of cases where where they were assisting women with advice to import illegal and dangerous abortion pills. But very, very difficult to get the Irish media to give that kind of expose the attention that it deserves.
What's the relation between the pro-life cause in Ireland and the Catholic Church in Ireland?
The character of the pro-life movement in Ireland has really nearly always been to stress that this is a non-denominational cause, that this is an issue for people of goodwill, of all faiths and none. And I think the reasons for that are, well, first of all, it's true, you know, it's a no-brainer, it's a matter of human dignity and human decency that abortion isn't the solution. But there's also a recognition that, you know, it is frankly counterproductive to make exclusively faith-based arguments, you know, for the protection of the unborn. You know, Ireland is a country in transition. It's a country where, you know, we've had our church scandals, where we have declining rates of mass attendance, where, you know, most young people are no longer frequent attenders at mass, at church on Sundays, even if they are baptized Catholics. Again, elements in the media have pushed a strong message that, you know, if you have a faith-based reason for what you think, you should leave that outside the door. You have no right to your, you know, faith inspiration for your values, which of course is nonsense, because everybody is coming from somewhere in terms of their philosophical, you know, reason for what they believe. But, you know, so there is definitely that, I would say, and the media and those who campaign for abortion tend to like to portray pro-life sentiment as something that is exclusively of religious interest, because using that tactic, you can persuade many ordinary, decent Catholics to say, oh, well, I'd better not impose my views. Meanwhile, everybody else's views get imposed on them. But so the pro-life campaign works very hard to say, you know, this makes sense if you're a person of faith. Of course, if you have a Christian inspiration for loving your neighbour, you know, it's going to make all the more sense. But it shouldn't require that. And I would have to say that there is great appreciation, I think, among church leaders for that kind of balanced and comprehensive approach by the pro-life campaign. You know, I think a lot of Irish bishops are very comfortable about the fact that this is a lay-led campaign, led by people of goodwill, many of whom have faith, some who may not. But, you know, they in the same way that the church has a message of social justice, whether it's the homeless, whether it's the persecuted minorities in the Middle East, you know, the church has a message of love and respect for people regardless of their faith. In the same way, I think the church is very conscious that this ought to be, you know, a civil society-based argument, you know, and that's what we seek to pursue. And I think it's appreciated, as I said, by pro-life people of all faiths and none.
If American listeners would like to contribute to the defense of Ireland's Eighth Amendment, what is the best way for them to do that?
Well, I'm really delighted that there is now a 501c3 called Cherish Life Ireland, based on the American side, which has been established to allow people to donate in a tax-efficient way towards pro-life charitable and educational activity in Ireland. And I would really encourage people strongly to consider making a donation. I think we'll probably always be in a David and Goliath situation, you know, vis-a-vis the George Soros's of this world. I think that's the current state of affairs. But you know, resources for pro-life education in Ireland can help us take the fight back to the George Soros's of this world. And frankly, we don't need as much as they do, because we have people on the ground, you know, who are willing to share the pro-life message confidently and with love and respect for other people. But it would be nice it would be great, in fact, to, you know, to push back against this cultural colonialism coming from Mr. Soros and his friends. So I would really encourage Americans who care about Ireland, maybe because of their heritage, or who care about the unborn because of our shared interest in protecting and promoting human dignity, to see the importance of what happens here in Ireland. This is a golden opportunity to join the fight to protect something very rare, which is constitutional protection of unborn children in the Western world. You know, we've got something really special, and we've got a very winnable fight, actually, because I think a lot of people, as I've said, of all faiths and none, see the value of a culture that honours both women and their unborn children. This is summed up in the pro-life campaign's concept, love both. You know, protecting babies and supporting mothers. And, you know, that's a message that appeals to Irish people. And, you know, if we can carry the day when this comes to a decision by the Irish people, I think it's going to have a very positive impact in other countries as well. So I would ask people to please consider making space in their charitable giving for Cherish Life Ireland.
And the URL is cherishlifeireland.org. Ronan, thank you so much for talking to us.
Thank you for your time and your interest.
And best of luck.
Thank you so much.
On Sunday, February 5th, the New England Patriots met the Atlanta Falcons in Super Bowl 51. The Patriots were favored to win. They had, after all, appeared in the Super Bowl 7 times since the 2001 season and won 4 times. But at halftime, the Patriots trailed the Falcons 21-3. With 8:31 left in the third quarter, they trailed 28-3. And then Tom Brady came alive and made New England great again. The Patriots won by a touchdown in overtime. Rusty, did you participate in the secular liturgy? Why or why not?
Yes, I did. I'm not a big guy for watching sports on TV, but my wife is a hardcore Patriots fan, and so I had a mandatory attendance to that particular secular liturgy. And we left in the third quarter from where we were watching the game, because we don't have a TV at home. And when we got home, my wife was following it all on social media at the very end, and she went to bed very happy.
Why do you call it the secular liturgy?
It's the time in American on the American calendar. It's right up there with Thanksgiving, 4th of July picnic, Thanksgiving dinner, Super Bowl party. That's kind of the big three.
The red letter days.
Those are the red letter days, yep.
Trump told us that if he became president, America would win so much we would get sick of winning. Well, the Patriots win so much, the rest of America gets sick of their winning. They're not exactly America's team as the Dallas Cowboys once were.
Let's back up on that. As a Baltimore Colts fan in the 1970s, the Dallas Cowboys were not my team.
Okay, well, yeah. I mean, these designations are always sort of exclusionary in some way. But are the Patriots the team of destiny in Trump's America?
The Patriots are the New York, have become the New York Yankees of National Football League, much beloved by their fans, who are beginning to regard it as a natural right to win the Super Bowl, maybe not every year, but certainly two out of every three. And so they're ecstatic and they're ready for more. The rest of us, I agree. Now, again, I'm married to a Patriots fan, so I am deeply and profoundly and in every respect loyal to the Patriots, but I can imagine how other Americans are tiring of this.
I think my favorite point of analogy between the Super Bowl and the election, between the Patriots and Trump, had to do with 538.com and the predictions that were fluctuating so wildly during election night and during the Super Bowl and were so massively falsified.
I resist drawing strong analogies between sports and politics.
I normally do too, but these are precisely the people who insist on mixing sports and politics by applying the same completely absurd data crunching techniques to them. Anyway, I just think that on both these big nights, election night and Super Bowl night, you found that these predictive models not only cannot predict the future, they cannot predict what they will predict, you know, 5 minutes in the future. So I'm just enjoying the way in which data punditry is sort of, the models keep breaking in these very public ways after maybe 8 or 10 years of being constantly ascendant. On the night of Friday, February 3rd, some person or persons unknown walked abroad in the city of Rome and decked the ancient city with anti-Pope posters, bearing an image of a grimacing Francis and the question, "Where is your mercy?" The posters lodged a few complaints, that the Pope has decapitated the Knights of Malta, ignored the Dubia Cardinals, and discouraged the use of the traditional Mass, and so on. The posters were hastily papered over, and the culprits remain unidentified and at large. Rusty, can you account for your whereabouts and the whereabouts of your staff on the night of Friday, February 3rd?
I can neither affirm nor deny that I was in the city of Rome. Although, what a great prank.
I know, wasn't it?
I read that news story and looked at the poster and had to chuckle. You know, for those of us who spent time in academia, we know the authoritarian liberal personality very well. And the Holy Father has moments when he manifests that personality type with particular clarity. And this particular poster campaign kind of got him on that one.
Right. Now, we're also told that Pope Francis may meet President Trump in late May around the G7 summit in Italy, which would make the first time Francis and Trump have ever been seen in the same room together. So if it does nothing else, this meeting should at least dispel the popular notion that the Pope and the President are the same person. That is, if it happens. So, Rusty, what are your expectations?
Maybe the Pope will disinvite the President, just as so many university presidents have disinvited various speakers. No, obviously the meeting, I'm sure, will come off. Both of these guys are political pros in their own way, and both of them are interestingly quite similar. I often refer to Pope Francis as having kind of a verbal semi-automatic weapon. He just pops off and says things, especially on airplanes at press conferences. And of course, we have this Twitter president who says all kinds of crazy things in the wee hours of the morning. So in some ways, there may be a kind of rapport between these two. I don't know. I wish I could be a fly on the wall and overhear that conversation.
We're also told that White House advisor Steve Bannon is in contact with Raymond Leo Burke, the fabulous traditionalist American cardinal who's fallen from favor during the Francis pontificate. Bannon is a Catholic of a conservative bent, and the New York Times would have us believe, just as Mr. Bannon has connected with far-right parties threatening to topple governments throughout Western Europe, he has also made common cause with elements in the Roman Catholic Church who oppose the direction in which Francis is taking them. Yet, there is no Bannon-Burke anti-Francis axis, according to one insider. Rusty, what do you think Bannon and Burke talk about when they're alone?
Well, I don't know whether they talk. I gather they've had some contact with each other, and I was reading something about some sort of email back and forth. So maybe there is contact there. I don't know what the nature of their conversations would be. But let me speculate. I would say this. I think that you have in Burke's Catholic traditionalism an anxiety about the dispersal or disillusion of a distinct Catholic way of life, a distinct Catholic sacramental system and canon law. So you could put it this way. Burke is attacking Francis for a kind of, if you will, open borders policy with respect to the divorce and remarried and communion. And then, of course, Bannon with respect to a kind of nationalistic approach to economics and other matters. And then to say nothing of the executive order that put a halt to travel and the influx of refugees from certain Muslim countries. That's also an attack on, if you will, a kind of open border ideology that's associated with globalism. So, I mean, maybe there's some kind of harmony of interest there, and that might draw those two men together, which is kind of an interesting, it's an interesting thought. Although I think the conspiratorial anxieties or the anxieties of many liberals about some sort of conservative conspiracy is a bit overwrought. Of course, there's a lot of crazy speculation going around as people try to figure out, you know, we're so disoriented by events, they're trying to latch on to something. So I think this is a very idle speculation by journalists who are trying to find something to say because, to be quite frank, they don't really know what to say.
Yeah, I think that there's a particular fascination with Bannon and the mind of Bannon and sort of what's his philosophy and what's his, you know, view of, what's his grand unified theory of history and these things, because he seems to be thought to be the theorist of sort of Trumpism. And so if we can just sort of figure out how Bannon thinks, then we'll figure out where things are going to go.
Right. I think that's correct that people have this. They want the key, the magical key that'll unlock this mysterious box. When I never met Steve Bannon, I have no idea the way he thinks. He's never written anything systematic for me to read. Everything that people speak about is gleaned from very offhanded interviews and comments. But I do know people who are hedge funders, and this kind of, what I would describe it, kind of solo, risk-taking investor types. And my experience with them is that they are often kind of have very omnivorous intellects. They like to entertain radical hypotheses, but they just entertain them and discard them. They entertain them and they discard them because what they're trying to do as investors is trying to get leverage over the herd mentality, to get some kind of distance from group opinion in order to find some avenue and angle that that will allow them to have some sort of competitive advantage. And so I think it's probably a mistake to think that Steve Bannon has some sort of settled, articulate, you know, philosophy of history or geopolitical vision. And I think it's probably more likely that he has, I'm sure, many deep instincts. And I think, you know, an afternoon of conversation might give one a clear indication of that. But that it's much more mobile and responsive to events than most people are willing to recognize at this point.
Neil Gorsuch, the executive order on LGBT policies, draft order on RFRA. As the Trump administration kicks off, how is religious liberty faring and what's the outlook?
I look at these preliminary signals, and what I see is the Utah Compromise. And the Utah Compromise was the Mormon Church deciding to affirm LGBT rights in exchange for very robust protections of religious liberty and a kind of gentleman's agreement with the LGBT movement not to push the envelope. And of course, Trump administration can't do that alone, but it seems to be staking out a position of affirmation of LGBT rights as they currently stand, de-weaponization of religious liberty, so no longer can be used as a way for the LGBT crowd to push their agenda forward. And then it seems like a pretty robust and thoroughgoing pro-life commitment. And I look at that set of commitments on this administration and think, on the whole, that's a very good outcome.
Finally, let's talk women's fashion.
Very important.
Ivanka Trump's clothing line has been dropped by Nordstrom, Neiman Marcus, and other stores, presumably because of calls to boycott it. Her father responded with a tweet, "My daughter Ivanka has been treated so unfairly by Nordstrom, etc." Aide Kellyanne Conway made a sales pitch during an interview from the White House briefing room. Buy Ivanka's stuff. Rusty, your thoughts?
Kellyanne Conway said something very stupid because it is, I think it's actually a statute prohibiting executive office appointees from promoting or in any way trying to provide financial benefit to others. I gather from the news reports that she was subsequently counseled by White House lawyers that she's not to do that again. So, dumb move, very sad.
Sure, I can top that. Anything else will be a come down. I hope you've been enjoying the First Things podcast. Now here's your chance to join the conversation. First Things will host an intellectual retreat at Baylor University in Waco, Texas, on May 19th through the 21st. It's a weekend of seminars and lectures with the faculty of the Baylor Honors College. Thomas Hibbs will give the keynote. Podcast contributors Rusty Reno, Mark Bauerlein, and Elliot Milko will be on hand, along with a lively contingent of readers and friends of First Things. You'll enjoy good company and elevated conversation, as well as cocktails and multiple dinner courses. The theme will be the good of marriage. Surprise your sweetheart with a registration on Valentine's Day. You can find out more by visiting our website at firstthings.com/retreat. That's firstthings.com/retreat. Space is limited. In registration, as in romance, carpe diem. That's all for this episode of the First Things podcast. Thanks to Senator Ronan Mullen for his efforts in defense of unborn life in Ireland. Remember, the 501c3 is at cherishlifeireland.org. That's cherishlifeireland.org. Thanks to my colleague, Rusty Reno. And thank you, listeners.